Hello, my name's Tony Dobbs and you're here at London Zoo in the Claw Rainforest Pavilion and you're listening to the Guardian Science Weekly podcast.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Nell Bowes. On this week's podcast, we talk about quantum information theory, everything you've ever wanted to know but were afraid to ask.
The most fundamental entity then really becomes information, rather than, you know, matter or energy or whatever you would conventionally think of.
NASA has Houston. Now Britain has Swindon. It's the launch of the UK Space Agency.
Mini and micro satellites. We're seeing a transition to low-cost launches, what Virgin Galactic is doing, finding ways of getting equipment into space more cheaply.
We'll also meet the winner of this year's Templeton Prize, which honours the spiritual side of science.
Religion and science are two windows through which we look at the world, and the world is the same, but what we see through those windows is completely different.
And find out why a rainforest has been created in the middle of London.
Down on the ground, you've got the grey-winged trumpeter. They're a bit like a sort of chicken species. Are commonly used in Peru as a form of guard dog because of the noise they make when strangers approach.
This is Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. Welcome to the pod. Today we're talking about quantum information theory. And who better to talk about it than Vlatko Vedral? He's a professor of quantum information theory at the Universities of Singapore and Oxford. Vlatko, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much.
And now I believe you have a new book out called Decoding Reality. It's all about quantum information theory. Before you tell us about the book, can you just explain what is quantum information theory?
Yes, I think probably the best way to understand it is from the computational perspective. So what the field is trying to do of quantum information is really to take all the information we have in current computers, if you think of your laptop as it is, and try to squeeze it into only a few atoms. And of course, you gain a lot in terms of memory efficiency. But what happens somewhere in between as well is that the laws of physics change from everyday classical physics, as we call it, Newtonian laws, down to quantum laws. And what we've discovered actually is that quantum laws allow you to process information much more effectively. And that's the key to this, that we can solve some problems much, much faster than with anything we have currently.
So I want to bring in Ian Sample here, Ian, yes. Our science correspondent. Hello, Ian. How are
Hi.
You?
Good. Vlatko, can you say something about what we gain from seeing reality as a quantum system as opposed to a classical system? Because it sounds as if, to me, and I'm not familiar with this area anywhere near as much as I should be, that you're saying from a classical viewpoint, we learn so much about the universe, reality, we can see it in such and such a way, but looking at it through as a quantum system, we get more depth and there's something more there.
Yes, I think that's a very important point, actually. And this is why technologically we'd like to be at the quantum level, because we know that we gain an extra dimension that we didn't have in the classical domain. And I think the main aspect is very simple to explain, and it's the following one. Quantum systems, so small systems such as atoms, subatomic particles, you know, particles of light, all of them have the feature that they can exist in many different states at the same time. So you can find an atom basically localized here on Earth and at the same time existing on the moon. It can be as far apart as that. And I think it's exactly this. This is something we call a superposition in quantum physics. It's exactly this property, and if you extrapolate it and say, can it exist in 100 different locations at the same time? And the answer is yes, it can, actually, and we have experimental evidence for that. Then you can see that if you could get each of these locations to be an independent computer and do a different computation, suddenly you've got a massive parallel computer just based on a single individual atom. And that's exactly what we'd like to be able to do.
This idea of quantum effects being used by life, being used in biology, and this new newish field of quantum biology just sounds fascinating. I wondered if you could say something about how living animals in particular might use quantum theory.
Yes, I think that's really a fascinating aspect. And in fact, it really links nicely to the research that I've been doing for last 5 to 10 years. Because at some stage we discovered that it seems to us that there is no limit how large an object can be and still display this weird feature of being in many different locations at the same time. And then you naturally ask yourself, you know, if an inanimate object, such an atom or a bunch of atoms, can do that, then could it be that nature, that living systems have also evolved to utilize this somehow to their advantage? And we have two actually strong examples where we believe that this is the case, and there is some experimental evidence there as well. One is in photosynthesis, which is basically the enigma there. Is how do plants manage to grab the sunlight with a very, very high efficiency? So plants seem to be better detectors than any man-made detectors we have. So they can grab a photon, you know, from a stream of photons from light, basically with almost a 100% efficiency, which is nothing we can do. And the question is, how can they do it? And in fact, it seems that they managed to do that simply by utilizing this fact of a molecule inside the plant being in a super, you know, in many different states at the same time. And then through a massive parallel quantum computation, things actually somehow converge to one point much faster than they would if this was governed by classical physics. But actually, the other example, I said there were two examples. The other, I think, is even more fascinating, and it's to do with a particular type of a bird. I think we actually think there are many more animals out there that can do that, but there's strong evidence to suggest that one particular bird, it's called the European robin. And this bird flies from the Scandinavia in winter, basically down to the equatorial plains of Africa, where it's warmer, obviously. And the question is, how do the birds make this huge journey without getting lost? So how do they navigate? And the idea is that, of course, what they have to be able to tell is the direction of the magnetic field of Earth. And what's fascinating there is it seems that they are really utilizing full, small scale, in this case, quantum computation to do that. And that's really amazing to us. So they don't use a conventional compass, if you like. They really use a much more sophisticated effect to do that.
So can you just explain how that effect works? I don't think I really understand.
Yes. So the first interesting piece of evidence was basically there is a group of scientists in Frankfurt who every January they basically set up huge nets and they capture the European robin as they try to fly from Scandinavia down to Africa. And then they do some experiments on them, which I think are very animal friendly, incidentally. I think all the birds survive all of this and there are no issues, you know.
Just throw that in there.
That's right. And I think what they do is they put them in inside some kind of cages where they vary the magnetic field and then they try to see where the birds would naturally go, which direction. And what they noticed maybe some 30 years ago is that when they reverse the direction of the north and the south of the magnetic field, the birds still go in exactly the same direction. So basically, they do not use a compass, because if they did use a compass, the compass needle would make exactly the same change as the external field, and the birds would have to go in the opposite direction. But they actually don't notice that at all. The only thing they notice is the inclination of the magnetic field, so the angle that the field makes with respect to the surface of the Earth. That's all that matters to them, and they're able with this information to make the journey. And so if you ask yourself, how can they do that? You know, how come they don't use a compass? What really happens is that, and here is the other effect that features very prominently in my book, that's called quantum entanglement. And what this is really a type of correlation between quantum systems that really exceeds anything that you can have, again, in everyday classical world. And what happens in inside the retina of birds' eyes is that two electrons inside a very complicated molecule get excited by visible light. So again, you know, the light hits the retina of European robin. These electrons get excited, and then basically they become highly entangled. And the amount of entanglement that's contained, so the amount of quantumness, if you like, in some sense, directly gets translated into the strength of the magnetic field and the direction. And this is somehow, it seems to us that they are utilizing the full machinery of quantum mechanics, if you like, and quantum information to detect the field.
So they get a signal from that
they
molecule.
They get a signal
then...
from that, yeah, that's right. That somehow, at some stage, this gets converted into chemistry, and from then on, they see the magnetic
into
field.
Into a neural
like,
signal,
that's
into thing. That's fascinating.
It's fascinating, yes.
In the pod, we also have Robin McKee, the Observer Science Editor. Robin, would you like to jump in and ask Vlatko?
Have I any questions? I've got a headache. yes. I mean, I think the biological aspects of what you're talking about is actually, to me, the most interesting ones.
Yes.
I mean, you've given us two examples. Is that it?
These are two big examples. I think there are many more examples of quantum effects and possible quantum effects in biological system. One of them that I find extremely fascinating, and again, it's related to one of the chapters in my book, is simply the way that the DNA replicates. So if you think about it, the DNA really works with two bits of information. So there are four base pairs on one strand of the double helix of the DNA that each of them have to basically find a corresponding base pair on the other DNA strand. And then somehow they match, pair up together. And this is how, you know, the DNA zips up, if you like, at some level. And for a long time, it was thought that this process is a simple classical dynamics, you know, like the lock and the key mechanism, where one of these molecules simply feels the other molecule, the shape of the other molecule, and they bind together in that way. But I think recently it was discovered that there are genuine quantum effects where you can have a state where you are kind of locked to two different base pairs at the same time. And this would be exactly an instance of the superposition effect that I mentioned earlier.
So these are entities in each side of the...
These are entities in each side of the DNA strand. So it would be... It really sounds amazing that at some stage the DNA is undecided as to how to pair up. And in fact, you exist in kind of two different genomes, if you like. You know, the properties that the entity will have are at some stage genuinely not decided. And it's very reminiscent of something that we call the Schrödinger cat.
Oh,
Indeed. So this is the famous... basically, it was presented as a paradox by Schrödinger that you know, if I claim that every atom can exist in two different states at the same time, and cats... or humans, or anything else in the universe, are nothing but a bunch of atoms, is the consequence of that cats can also exist in two different states at the same time. And I think Schrödinger deliberately chose a dead and alive cat to make it as, you know, as dramatic as possible. And I think this, in a way, the field now is going towards that direction. You know, I think he meant it as a genuine paradox. He meant it can't be like this, because if you extrapolate... you will get something as ridiculous as a dead and alive cat. But I think the way we're going now, it seems to be confirming that probably one day, you know, with enough sophistication experimentally, we'll be able to generate larger and larger superpositions.
I thought the paradox was that you the cat's in the box, and until you look, the cat is neither dead nor alive.
That's exactly another aspect, and I'm very happy that you brought it up, actually. It's something we call the measurement problem. So at which point does the cat become dead or alive? How does that happen? Because you are absolutely right that we don't see dead and alive cats in the real world. So there is a genuine question there. How come we see either a dead cat or an alive cat? How does that work? Can you explain that quantum mechanically?
Can we quit now? I asked an intelligent question.
Do you get a gold star? Absolutely fascinating. If you want more of this to blow your mind, do get Vlatko's new book. It's called Decoding Reality. And you can find out more at vlatkovidral.org.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Britain now has its equivalent of NASA, and it's based in Swindon. Yes, the UK Space Agency was launched last week. But what does it actually mean? Science correspondent Ian Sample has been finding out. Ian, who have you been speaking to?
Well, I went down for the launch of the UK Space Agency, and what fun that was. I mean, we actually had Tim Peake, UK's, and the phrasing is, first official astronaut, up on stage pushing a big green button, which caused a 10-9-8 countdown, to which everybody apart from me probably joined in and clapped along and revealed our logo.
Oh, you old cynic.
Which is very kind of Austin Powers and the sort of red, white and blue arrows and things. It was just a memorable moment, shall I say. But it was launched by Lord Mandelson, business secretary, and Lord Drayson, the science minister. And I caught up with Paul Drayson, the science minister, and asked him why we need a space agency.
We spend about £230 million a year of taxpayers' money. Not having an agency has meant that coordinating that spending hasn't been as effective as it needs to be. Today, we fix that.
We did have the British National Space Centre, which we still do have, and that will last for a few more weeks then. But these, how will this new space agency really overcome what presumably must have been shortcomings with the BNSC?
I think it will provide, firstly, clarity of where the decision-making takes place. As science minister, when negotiating with international partners on projects such as the GMES satellite project, I've had to coordinate activity across a number of government departments. That takes time and means that the UK's negotiating position isn't as strong as it could be if we had a better way of doing things. So it's about getting better coordination and more efficient spending of the money which we put into space. The other thing is about raising the profile of an area where the UK is a real leader. We're second only to the United States in what we do in space research. We have a very successful space industry making things such as satellites in robotics. And this is not really generally known. So we need to raise that profile. It's employing something like 68,000 people, making a very significant contribution to the UK economy. And it hasn't missed a beat through this recession. So it's just the sort of sector which is going to provide the jobs and growth of the future.
You talked today about this being the time to go for growth in space industry, but you know very well that there are universities that are complaining that they've had to cut PhD studentships, that they are feeling the bite of the recession because of government cuts. What do you think has to happen for your aspirations not to be undermined?
All aspects of public spending need to look for efficiency savings. We're going through a tough economic downturn. We're just starting to see a fragile recovery. So we've got to do everything we can to make sure that every pound of taxpayers' money that we spend is spent as efficiently as possible. But at the same time, we've got to maintain our investment in those areas which are going to drive future economic growth. Now, Britain has fantastic talent in science and engineering. Our high-tech manufacturing is a world leader. We shipped just the other week £1 billion worth of satellites from the South Coast.
That was Lord Drayson talking about the new UK Space Agency. Robin, what do you think about the Space Agency?
It's a sensible move. I mean, basically, it coordinates all our space endeavours into one agency that actually has powers to spend its own money, which the BNSC didn't have before. It had to go with a begging bowl to other government departments and say, please, can we have this money for this rocket or this particular satellite, which was daft. But you've got to say, given what's going to come after the next general election and the cuts, and it's going to be in government budgets all right through the system.
Ian Sample, did you think Lord Drayson was doing a good job?
I think this is undoubtedly a good thing. The previous system was kind of actually an embarrassment. I mean, most other nations, you know, certainly within ESA, have their own agencies which have executive power. So you can actually, you know, the European Space Agency can call somebody and get a decision and get people around the table rather than that person saying, well, I have to go and talk to, you know, Department for Environment, Department of Transport and all the rest of it and see if anyone likes it. And those people all disagree. And so things take a long time. I mean, things get done, but not very quickly. I agree with or I share Robin's concerns about what happens with this post-election. I mean, I was talking to the person who put the legal framework together for the new body, and I couldn't help wondering if it was sort of, you know, you have to get this done before the election because you want it kind of tied down, at least in some sense, before someone comes in and decides that we don't want a space agency. And let's not forget, you know, that it was a basically previous Tory government that decided we shouldn't really be doing much in space. So that is a worry, I think. What we'll be doing how it will fare budget-wise is a biggie. The one thing I will say very finally is that this push to get three missions for the UK and to lead three missions is an awful lot about getting money. Those three missions, if they can get them, will be picked very carefully to return a lot of contracts to the UK and make money out of them.
Vlatko, does this impact on you at all? How does it? Will it affect your work?
I don't know if it affects me directly, but I think it's a very important move, actually. I think it's a very valuable enterprise. And actually, some time ago, I made a comment that I think that it was a little bit controversial probably at the time. I made a comment that I think it's probably too late for us to reverse the effects of global warming. And I think the best chance we have probably in the long run is to start to colonize at some stage other planets. So I believe that we have to get out there. I'm not sure, you know, the budget probably for this space agency will not allow us to get quite there. But I think it's not too early now to start to explore space and, you know, at least send maybe unmanned missions out there to see what we could do.
So should we be spending money on the space agency? Should we be sending missions to Mars? Leave your thoughts on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Make sure you subscribe for free while you're there, so every podcast gets automatically delivered to your MP3 device or iPod. It takes all the hard work out of listening. Now, good news if you're a red titi monkey hanging around the nation's capital. London Zoo has built a living rainforest. A giant biodome has been constructed as a vast breeding facility for monkeys, sloths, birds and bugs. There's real rain and living trees, and the temperature is kept at nearly 30 degrees. We went down there to check it out.
There you go, lads.
All right, don't fight.
David Field, I'm Zoological Director of London Zoo. What we've done with the plant species is been working with a sustainable nursery in Costa Rica, and we've been bringing in plant species from this particular nursery. So we've got some amazing species in here, like the sickle plant down there, which was a forerunner of chewing gum. We've got my favourite is absolutely the stilt palm or the walking palm. It's kind of a real life triffid. It does actually, well, in theory, it walks. It's amazing. Walks at a very, very slow pace. And then comes what makes this different. Different to anywhere else. It's the fact that you've got titi monkeys, emperor tamarins, sloth, tamandua, sunbitterns, pope cardinals, Montserrat oriole. Just the species list is dynamic. And these species are running amongst you just there, because the other animal in this environment is the human. They're sharing this space with all of these primates, which makes it so special.
Well, over there you've got the red titi monkeys. There's a pair of them, breeding pair. They stay very close together. They're
Tony Dubs, and I'm a senior keeper. We've increased all the humidity and the temperature, so it is very, very humid and very warm in here now. That's the mist is firing off now, just to keep the humidity up. We aim to keep it around 80% humidity, so that's a very, very high humidity. Not what we're used to, but very similar to what they would experience in the wild.
All these animals that we've got here are being born in zoos, either born in here or born as part of conservation programs from other zoos across Europe. How we manage them? Well, we have to start using almost field techniques. So it's very important that the techniques that we can develop here in this biome can then be translated to the field, because we do often need to say trap the lion tamarins in the field to survey them, to check them and things like that. But one of the neat things that we do here is that not necessarily training the animals, but we target the animals, target train them, so they will come down for a reward. So each of the animals in here will come down to take food from the keeper's hands. So in that way we can make sure that we can always give them their extra vitamins, or on the occasion when we need to give them a vitamin supplement, we can do that, or some medication. Could you imagine trying to net an animal in this environment? Almost impossible.
You can watch a video of the new exhibit at guardian.co.uk/video. You can also join our Facebook group. Handily, we've called ourselves the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. You can chat with other listeners and post comments on the wall. We only need another 100 people to give us 2,000 members, which would almost make us a cult. Now on to the Templeton Prize, which was announced last week. The Templeton Foundation supports scientific investigation of what it calls the big questions, from the laws of nature to the nature of love. The Templeton Prize is also the world's largest annual monetary award given to an individual. It's bigger even than the Nobel Prize. It honours work of a spiritual nature. So the man who's £1 million better off is Francisco Ayala, an evolutionary geneticist and a former priest. We'll discuss some of the issues this controversial prize throws up in just a moment. But first, let's hear from the man himself.
I have been speaking about the dialogue between science and religion for many years. I have participated in many, many dialogues with the religious groups. I have been invited by the Vatican to speak about evolution. I once, in the 1996, organized the 10-day symposium that took place in Castel Gandolfo, the summer residence of the Pope. I'm very often invited to write in religious and theological journals, so in scientific journals about the dialogue between science and religion. By scientific journals, I mean general purpose journals. Obviously, in technical journals, I don't write about religion and science. And I speak often in universities and in churches and seminaries and the public in general about these matters. To me, it's very important because I think the reluctance of many people in the United States to accept science and the theory of evolution in particular is based on the grounds that they think that's antagonistic to their religious faith.
There are people in the U.S. who are a lot of scientists who are concerned about things like intelligent design and creationism finding their ways onto school curricula. What is your stance on that? What do you make of that?
Well, it should not be taught in science classes. You know, intelligent design, the so-called, is not a scientific theory. And again, the so-called creationism is not a scientific theory. Now, there are people who say, why don't you teach both sides? Well, the response is very obvious. You don't want to teach astrology with astronomy and alchemy with chemistry and witchcraft with medicine. We have enough to do by teaching good science. We don't need to teach in science classes things that are not scientific. That these matters be discussed in other people, another kind of lectures or classes is fine. As a historical or religious phenomena, they are interesting, but they certainly do not belong in science classes.
How do you personally square a faith, presuming you still have it, with which you know assumes no evidence, with science which demands it?
Sometimes I put it this way, that religion and science are two windows through which we look at the world, and the world is the same, it's one world, but what we see through those windows is completely different. I argue that evolution and science in general are more compatible with faith in an omnipotent and benevolent God than the concepts of creationism of intelligent or intelligent design, which I think are not compatible with the Christian faith. The people who propose them, they argue that they are more compatible, and there's the reason why they are proposing these ideas. But when one looks into the implications of those ideas, they are definitely unacceptable from a religious point of view. They should be. It is my view.
You'll know as a scientist and a former president of the AAAS that there are some scientists out there who are who criticise the Templeton Foundation for one of them said to me that they blur the lines between science and religious activity. Does that concern you at all? And did you have any reservations about accepting the award?
No, the award was given to me, I hope, on good grounds. But actually, I was nominated by the president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, so he didn't have misgivings nominating me. I should not have misgivings accepting it, it seems to me.
That was Francisco Ayala, winner of the Templeton Prize, talking to Ian Sample from our Washington office. So the Templeton Prize strays straight into that whole religion-science debate. It's quite controversial. There's been a hell of a fuss about it being presented at the National Academy of Sciences. Certainly Richard Dawkins has waded in as well. Ian, what's your take on it?
I don't know if I understand this enough to give any to say, yeah, I'm confident to say what I think on it, to be honest. I mean, and I'm being kind of...
That was a bit of wishy-washy.
Look.
Yes, look. Robin's prepared to jump in. Go on, Robin.
Let me explain a little bit. There are an awful lot of scientists that are absolutely fine and have no problem whatsoever with the Templeton Foundation, which intentionally sets the value of this prize to be above that of the Nobels because they want to ensure that any work in sort of spiritual domain is deemed at least as good as work in the sciences. Okay, I have a personal problem with that. I don't think that's really, you know, the case. I don't think we really gain anything. I mean, I don't think I gain anything from having a viewpoint of the world that involves super beings and things like this and a sort of another agency. It doesn't, you know, but this is very personal. I don't really think, you know, this doesn't mean I think anyone else should think that. You can think what they want. Now, there are some other scientists who are just livid about this and who think that the National Academy of Sciences, this is the US's most prestigious scientific institution, that they should not be anywhere near involved with this organization because they do feel that the Templeton Foundation, by honoring scientists and being involved with scientific institutions, is gaining credibility for itself, whereas what it is doing is trying to sort of, what they see it's trying to do is foster credibility for spiritual ways of viewing the world, which scientists just say, look, this is just nonsense, it's bollocks, there's no evidence for it, so you can't, you know, that shouldn't be, science should be nowhere near that. And I'm more in that camp, I've got to say.
Well, I think we should just take the £1 million and run, you know, because I've got some £1 million I can spend in research and provide further proof that God doesn't exist. So, I mean, that's hoping.
So, Robin McKee, not bothered?
It's a bit silly, but yes, I do take Ian's point about the NES giving it credibility. And that does worry me. On the other hand, if they want to give me the £1 million, I'm quite prepared to say I was wrong before that. I just look forward to the day they give it to Richard Dawkins.
And then he
takes the money and runs and says, you know, bollocks.
But it is interesting as to whether there is a bias that this brings or whether there's a kind of... there was a chap on Edge, Richard Horgan, talking about how he'd been one of the Templeton Fellows and felt quite compromised by the process. Vlatko, would you be a Templeton Fellow? Would you take a Templeton Prize?
Yes.
I mean, I think you have to be very careful in this respect. I mean, I'm not religious, and I think I agree with Ian that it seems to me that it's very difficult to believe in God if you really live the scientific method. I think, you know, there is a clash between these two cultures.
So it's not that they're kind of separate, non-overlapping magisteria or whatever?
I wouldn't say. They certainly have a large overlap. And I think, obviously, in the overlapping domain, I follow science. And I think it's a better way of finding out about the world. But of course, there is probably a personal domain which I think is completely individual. And obviously, science has nothing to say about it. And I think that's where you have to be careful when you're trying to bridge the gap between science and religion. And if you really claim to fund scientists, then I think you have to fund them to do their work their own way and really to make it subject to experimental tests, because physics, after all, is experimental science. And I think you cannot start to mix in other methods that may come from philosophy or religion. So you have to be very careful to draw a line there. So, you know, having said that, I would take the funding from them. So long as, of course, I'm allowed to have my independence and integrity. I think.
And your yacht as well.
That's right, my yacht. I would certainly accept a yacht. I guess I've blown my chances by admitting that I'm not religious of getting any Templeton Prize. But
now I'm sure you've got your own views on science and religion and who should be doing the funding. Do tweet about it. You can follow this podcast on Twitter. We're at Science Weekly. And we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. To be alerted to all The Guardian science content, Follow at Guardian Science.
Science Weekly.
Okay, that's it for this week. Our thanks to our quantum information specialist, Vlatko Vedral, and our podcast regulars, Ian Sample and Robin McKee. If you want more from Robin, you can check out the Observer's Science page, where he'll have all the latest on the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. Next week, we'll have Jonathan Bulcombe in the studio. He researches animal behaviour and will be telling us about the inner lives of our pets. Plus, we'll have Peter Hadley discussing his YouTube channel, where he attempts to debunk climate myths. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. By the way, thanks for all your science-related jokes on last week's blog. I think this could be a bit of a running theme. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening.